280 at John Daly Boulevard. There's a barrel rolling around in the middle lanes, or a garbage can. And in Fremont, southbound 880, the off-ramp to Dakota Road. It's a car fire on the right shoulder. Lori Sanders for KQED.
Well, thank you, Lori. Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Repertory Theater presenting Galileo, a new rock musical starring Raul Esparza as the rebel astronomer. From the minds behind Spring Awakening and TV's Empire, playing through June 16th, berkeleyrep.org. And Earth Justice, a national legal nonprofit fighting for a healthy environment for all. More at earthjustice.org. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer. This American Life is coming your way at noon today. Former President Donald Trump has a plan for a second term, retribution, a check-in with people who have crossed him in the past and to hear how they feel about possible retribution if that were to happen. This American Life at noon and again at 7 p.m. I'm Beth Huizinga. It's KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. We're live online at KQED.org and always on the KQED app. It's 9 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the scene at the U.S.-Mexico border today following President Biden's executive actions to limit asylum. Then Domenico Montanaro in the week in politics. Also, more than 30 countries have held elections so far this year. How is democracy doing? Hockey romance novels, rom-com slapshots, and Amy Dickinson leaves her Ask Amy column after 21 years of hearing the problems of people who seek her advice. Now she says,
I have taken to heart the lessons I've learned from giving advice. And here's what I know. I get one life and I have plans. So I'm leaving.
First, our newscast at Saturday, June 8, 2024.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Israel has carried out its largest hostage rescue operation since the war with Hamas began on October 7th. Israeli forces rescued four people, three men and one woman, who had been kidnapped by Hamas that day. IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari said the rescue was conducted in daylight in two separate buildings, deep inside Gaza, while under fire.
This was a high-risk, complex mission. Israeli forces have been preparing for this rescue mission for weeks. They risked their lives to save the lives of our hostages. This is what we do in Israel. We risk our lives to save the lives of our hostages.
The hostages are said to be in good medical condition and are being observed in an Israeli hospital. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading back to the Middle East as the White House seeks more support for its roadmap to peace in Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Secretary Blinken will be visiting Egypt and Qatar, the two countries that, along with the U.S., have been pushing Hamas and Israel to agree to a ceasefire. His spokesman says he will emphasize the importance of Hamas accepting the proposal that's on the table, which U.S. officials say is nearly identical to the one Hamas endorsed in May. The deal calls for a six-week ceasefire and the release of some of the hostages held in Gaza. It would also kick off negotiations on a permanent truce. The secretary will be visiting Israel on the trip, which begins on Monday. He'll also stop in Jordan, which is hosting a conference on humanitarian aid for Gaza. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
President Biden is on a state visit to France. He said Washington and the European Union are united in helping Ukraine fight the Russian invasion.
The EU has provided over $107 billion in assistance to Ukraine since the war began, because we know what happens if Putin succeeds in subjugating Ukraine.
He said if that happens, all of Europe will be threatened. Supreme Court justices released their financial disclosure statements yesterday. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports Justice Clarence Thomas used the 2023 disclosure forms to amend his 2019 disclosures.
At the end of his disclosure form, Thomas said that he'd inadvertently omitted a one-night stay at a hotel in Bali and a four-day stay at the Bohemian Grove, a fancy all-male club in California, both as a guest of GOP mega-donor Harlan Crow. The Bali amendment is puzzling because it omits any information about Thomas's flight to Indonesia on a private plane and the overnight stays on a yacht owned by Crowe, both of which were disclosed last year by ProPublica and never denied by Thomas. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. As part of Pride celebrations in San Francisco, a group of volunteers have set up a giant pink triangle on Twin Peaks. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman was there Friday as the annual art installation was assembled.
About 50 volunteers are fanned out on a steep slope overlooking the city on a gusty, foggy day. They're hammering down a pink piece of sailcloth 240 feet long and 5 feet wide that forms one of the sides of the triangle.
Can you bring people back this way?
Patrick Carney is the organizer of this art installation, now in its 29th year. During the Holocaust, Nazi soldiers made homosexuals wear pink triangles on their clothes as a way to identify and shame them. Carney says he created this project as a reminder of this history.
Part of appreciating and celebrating any pride is knowing where you've been. And this pink triangle is it, and it could happen again if we're not vigilant. So that's why we keep doing it. It's a giant in-your-face educational tool.
Among the volunteers here is Brian Berger.
It's impressive, and it's something we all can be proud of, whether you're gay, doesn't matter what you're gay, straight, or whatever. You're part of the community, and it's pride. Pride in yourself. And pride being here. It's emotional.
The triangle will remain up until after the city's Pride Parade on June 30th. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
Find more news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Support for NPR comes from Project Lead the Way, where they believe learning by doing helps every student in every grade be STEM successful. Learn more at pltw.org/NPR. And the listeners of KQED. Well, cloudy skies right now, and we'll have some hazy sunshine later on with lots of wind up to about 20 miles per hour, maybe a little bit gustier, and then that's coming out of the west today. Cool temperatures, 64 expected for high in San Francisco, 68. The high expected in Oakland, 79 in San Jose, 77 in Sonoma County, 76 the high expected in the Napa Valley, and 88 in the Sacramento Valley.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thanks for being with us. It has been 4 days since President Biden's executive actions halting most asylum claims at the southern border have gone into effect, and now hundreds of migrants who attempted to cross into the U.S. illegally have been quickly deported, many of them to Mexico. NPR's immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran is in Tucson and joins us. Sergio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You were in Nogales yesterday on the Arizona-Mexico border. What did you see?
So yesterday I crossed into the Mexican side and I hung around the port of entry and also went to a migrant shelter called Juan Bosco. And in both places, Scott, I saw migrants who had just been deported. They were wearing purple bracelets with their personal information. They told me they had attempted to cross into the U.S. just a few days ago. And that's what Biden's executive actions were intended to do, right? To expedite the removals of migrants who cross illegally. But overall, I have to say I didn't see chaos or hecticness.
What did migrants you talked to in Mexico say?
Many of them were disappointed to be turned back. I talked to a woman named Liz. She's 30 years old. I met her right by one of the port of entries.
Tomamos la decisión de cruzar, pero no sabíamos que ya no estaba.
Liz is from Guerrero, Mexico, and she's fleeing cartel violence, so she didn't want us to use her last name. She told me that on Wednesday she tried to cross into the U.S. without authorization with her sons, ages 5 and 9, and she says she didn't know about the restrictions on asylum claims. So now she'll go back to Guerrero, the place she tried to flee.
So she may not be trying to cross again. What about other migrants?
Well, other migrants have the same story. Many of them told me that they are now trying to figure out what to do next. But I have to say, none of the people I talked to told me they were going to try to cross again, which is what the Biden administration wants, right? The goal is to deter migrants from crossing without authorization. Now, the Biden administration has said they want people to use legal pathways to claim asylum, like the CBP-1 app. That's the platform where migrants are encouraged to use to apply for asylum. The issue is that it is a lottery system, and there are only 1,500 appointments available per day. Guadalupe Flores from Michoacán, Mexico, waited 8 months, but yesterday she had her appointment.
Pues ha sido como que desesperante, pero a la vez con paciencia.
She says it's been maddening, but that it is the legal process, which means she won't have to risk her life or that of her 14-year-old son. I tried to reach out again late last night to see whether she was allowed to stay in the U.S., but she didn't answer.
Are border communities in Mexico ready for the surge?
Well, the shelters for immigrants have dealt with surges of migrants in the past, right? But the local Red Cross said over 200 people had been deported to Nogales, Sonora, by midday yesterday. So with hundreds of migrants deported every day, plus those already en route to the border, that could put a serious strain on cities like Nogales, which usually experience higher numbers of migrants during warmer months. Again, it is early. It's only been 4 days since the policy was implemented, but that's what it seems could happen in the days ahead.
NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran, thanks so much for being with us today, Sergio.
You're welcome.
Now we turn to NPR senior editor and political correspondent, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, good morning, Scott.
The president's been criticized by the progressive wing of his own party for imposing these asylum restrictions. He knew that would happen. Why did he do it?
Well, I mean, there's no denying immigration has just been a big problem for the Biden administration. I mean, only about 30% or so approve of Biden's handling of this issue. It's been a pretty hard one for him to shake. I mean, so Biden and his campaign really felt like they had to do something, especially since he's been thwarted at every attempt to work with Congress on the issue. I mean, just this past year, Biden thought he had a border security deal done that would have given Republicans a lot of what they wanted on border security in exchange for Ukraine funding. But House Republicans blocked that deal after former President Trump asked them not to sign on. He really wants this as a live issue in this election year.
Will these executive orders take the issue out of the campaign?
Probably not at all. You know, it's upset progressives Biden needs, as you said, and Republicans are certainly going to blame Biden no matter what on this issue. Biden hopes that he can at least get those who are open to voting for him to see that he's trying to do something on this issue. Remember, Biden won 51% in 2020. A lot of this election for Biden is trying to get those voters back on board.
The prosecution rested in the trial of Hunter Biden on gun charges yesterday, a sad time for the Biden family, especially as witnesses recounted Hunter Biden's drug use and the hurt it caused those who love him. Are there political implications?
I mean, it was a very emotional week, obviously, and it's never great, though, when the first family is in court with family members talking about their use of crack cocaine, especially in an election year. You know, Hunter Biden has been on the lips of conservatives and conservative media since Joe Biden was elected, since before he was elected. But I have to say, it might be a little risky for Republicans to overuse this. You know, you might remember in the 2020 campaign, Trump attacked Biden on stage for Hunter's drug use, and Biden turned it into one of his best moments, you know, really an empathetic moment, pointing out that lots of American families have dealt with a family member struggle with addiction, and that he's proud of his son for coming out the other side.
Been more than a week since Donald Trump was convicted on 34 felony charges. Still early, of course, but any indication if it's changing votes?
I think we can say that the conviction has overall been a net negative for Trump, but really only marginally. I mean, that's what polls had showed coming in, that that was most likely. And it seems to be playing out that way so far. It's only been a week since the conviction. We'll see if this is just a bump or something more lasting. More important is whether this moves any key groups that had been wavering about voting for Biden, in particular, younger voters who had been the most likely to say beforehand that they could be moved depending on the verdict. This election, you know, is expected to be close. Any movement on the margins could be decisive, of course.
President Biden is in France as we speak to observe the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy. In one speech, he said the heroes of that day are summoning us now.
They're not asking us to do their job. They're asking us to do our job, to protect freedom in our time, to defend democracy, to stand up aggression abroad and at home.
Domenico, he didn't mention Donald Trump by name, but...
Yeah. Well, this is a huge dividing line, foreign policy, between Biden and Trump. Very different approaches to the world. And there, Biden is implicitly warning against creeping isolationism and separation from allies, something Trump has really made a hallmark of his own foreign policy, really turning more inward. Biden is more of a traditionalist, believing that American involvement and moral leadership is very important around the world, as obviously was the case in World War II and after it. Of course, the backdrop of all this is the war in Ukraine. You know, Biden supports more funding of the war and standing behind the country under siege from Russia. With Trump, on the other hand, you know, there are lots of questions about maybe how much territory would he encourage Ukraine to give away to Russia in order to get the war to end. This is a very different approaches that we've seen from Biden and from Trump, and very different ways in which allies see the approach that the United States could take depending on who wins this election.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rows of white crosses and now and then a Star of David roll over the green bluffs at the U.S. Military Cemetery in Normandy. Part of the power is their simplicity and sameness. The headstones of 9,388 Americans, most of whom lost their lives in the Allied invasion of Normandy 80 years ago this week, are inscribed with name, rank, the division in which they served, and the date on which they gave their lives. No hometowns, ages, or jobs, no details of how they died. It is not because those things are insignificant, but because every person buried there fell in a common crucial cause, the battle to free Europe and defeat Nazism. Their families chose for them to stay there, above the beaches in Normandy, where they fought and now rest together. Nearby cemeteries hold the bodies of thousands more British, Canadian, and Commonwealth country soldiers who also died in Normandy that summer. I feel a personal debt to those soldiers, sailors, and flyers. As a child, my late mother-in-law, Marie-Amélie Richard, and her family spent 4 years living in the cellar of their Normandy farmhouse. German staff officers had taken over their home. Many of the young men buried in the bluffs of those cemeteries a few miles away were only a few years older than my mother-in-law and her teenage brothers and sisters. Those soldiers gave their lives for strangers in another country far from home. The American citizen soldiers knew the difference between right and wrong, wrote the historian Stephen Ambrose, and they didn't want to live in a world in which wrong prevailed, so they fought and won, and we, all of us, living and yet to be born, must be profoundly grateful. Our family spends a few weeks in Normandy every summer. We'll be there in a few days. At night we walk that beach where there was such blood, fire, fear, courage, and death 80 years ago. It's empty and majestic now. Our dog romps along the sand and plays with the waves. Our daughters run barefoot and pick up seashells. I feel that I owe my family to those soldiers who fell there and are buried just a few miles away. In a way, maybe we all do.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the boys are home again, all over the world, and rain or snow is all that may fall from the skies above. A kiss won't mean goodbye, but hello to love. When the lights go on again, all over the world,
Dame Vera Lynn, and you're listening to NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. SFO can make traveling easier with fast Wi-Fi, mobile driver's licenses accepted at security checkpoints, and prepaid parking. More at flysfo.com. And European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
Will AI become inescapable in the same ways as smartphones and social media? And if so, is it still possible to shape its role in our lives? As companies rush to incorporate AI into their business plans, this week I want to hit pause to ask questions the AI revolution might be skipping over. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's Been a Minute. It comes your way at 10 o'clock each Saturday morning.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Israeli military says its forces have rescued four people who had been taken hostage by Hamas militants on October 7th of last year, the deadly attack that started the war in Gaza. Officials say all four are in good medical condition. President Biden is welcoming the news of the rescue and said the U.S. and Israel won't stop working until all the hostages are home. Biden spoke in Paris, where he's on a state visit. And Supreme Court justices released their annual financial disclosure forms yesterday. Justice Clarence Thomas also amended his 2019 form, adding information about a hotel room and meals in Bali paid for by a Republican donor. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
More about the four rescued hostages. That story is coming up next in the next segment of Weekend Edition. Support for NPR comes from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at PublicWelfare.org. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. It's 921.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Four Israeli hostages have been rescued from central Gaza. They've been held since being kidnapped by Hamas-led militants on October 7 last year. This is the largest rescue of hostages alive since the war began. Details from the scene are still emerging. Officials at a Gaza hospital tell NPR's producer in Gaza that at least 94 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli rescue operation, which Israel says happened in the heart of a civilian neighborhood. Let's bring in NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Scott. Thank you.
Who has been rescued and how?
So the hostages were rescued were three men and one woman. They all range in age between 21 and 40, and they were all kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. Israel's military, police, and domestic security agency, they all participated in this rescue. They called it a, quote, so complex special daytime operation. It was in Nusayrat in central Gaza. Israel's military spokesman said that they were, quote, rescued under fire and were held in homes in the heart of a civilian neighborhood. And I should also just mention here that Nusayrat has been in the news lately. It's where lots of heavy fighting and Israeli bombardment has been happening in the past few days. And it's also where dozens of people were killed when an Israeli airstrike hit a UN school sheltering thousands of displaced people just a few days ago. The Israeli military says that this specific rescue operation had been in the planning, in the works for weeks.
What's known about how the hostages are doing?
So they haven't spoken publicly, but Israel says that they are all in good medical condition and are under observation in an Israeli hospital right now. The organization representing hostage families and their supporters issued a statement just now calling the operation, quote, heroic and a miraculous triumph. But they also called for the Israeli government to remain committed to bringing back all of the hostages still in captivity, both alive and dead.
And how is the news being received in Israel, as far as you can tell so far?
Yeah, well, I can tell you, Scott, that that I heard cheers that erupted around Tel Aviv when the news was announced today. It was so loud that I could hear them from where I was sitting in my apartment with the windows closed. So this is huge news here. You know, like you said, it's the largest recovery of hostages alive since the war began. And it's a big boost in morale, especially after just last week when the Israeli military pronounced four other hostages dead. You know, there's been growing pressure here from the Israeli public to get the hostages home. There's been weekly protests across the country and a real pressure pressure from the Hostages Family Forum, that group I just mentioned, meeting with members of the government. You know, a lot of Israelis feel that the main focus should be pausing the war and focusing on a hostage release deal. That's a main part of the three-part plan that Biden put forth last week, which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has yet to agree to.
And we have to ask, does this strengthen the prime minister politically?
You know, I think we have yet to see how this all plays out. You know, this news was only has only been public here for a few short hours. But, you know, it is already having an effect politically. Benny Gantz, who is a member of Netanyahu's three-person war cabinet, who is also Netanyahu's biggest rival, he had scheduled a press conference for later tonight, and many expected he would announce his resignation from the government. It was a kind of protest that Netanyahu isn't doing enough to get the hostages back and end the war. But after this news was announced, Gantz postponed that press conference. And so it'll be interesting to see if this rescue of hostages takes some pressure off Netanyahu for now from the public and within the government too. You know, it's a big win, and we'll see if people will be largely celebrating tonight or if those protests will continue to demand a return of all the hostages.
And here's Kat Lansdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Millions of people around the world have cast ballots in elections this year in over 30 countries, in an era of democracy in decline and authoritarianism on the rise. It's also a chance to check in with NPR's global democracy correspondent, Frank Langford. Frank, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Scott.
How's democracy doing this year?
I think so far, surprisingly well. I've been talking to a bunch of analysts, and they're more upbeat than I expected, you know, especially coming after so many years of decline. And what we're seeing, I think, is many elections are competitive. The best and obvious recent example was just this week, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India. His party, the BJP, Hindu Nationalist Party, lost their majority in parliament for the first time. And so this is a guy who, if you think about it, last week was seen as a juggernaut and is now humbled and weakened. Another example in March, a stunning story, which we covered as well in Senegal. The government tried to delay elections there. The Constitutional Court blocked it. And then there was this little known opposition politician released from prison as part of an amnesty. Weeks later, he ends up in the presidential palace.
But to what degree is democracy on the ballot? Are people voting for democratic leaders consciously against autocratic ones?
That's a really good question. It can be a factor in some elections, but more often people are voting on more tangible domestic issues. In South Africa, this is a really good example. Last week, voters really bashed the African National Congress. They lost their parliamentary majority as well. They've been in power for 30 years. You know, there's massive corruption and massive unemployment there. And I was talking, Scott, to Steve Levitsky. He's a professor of government at Harvard. He also wrote that book, How Democracies Die. And I asked him what drives voters around the world, and this is what he said.
Most voters are not thinking about democratic rules and procedures or rights, but most voters are thinking about a variety of different things. Sometimes it's their identity, sometimes it's pocketbook issues, sometimes it's things like crime, but they usually have other things on their mind.
Frank, what are the trends you're seeing?
The other thing that's really, I think, very important, especially here in the United States and in Western Europe, is this has been in recent years a difficult time for incumbents. Many voters are, you know, whether it's autocrats or whether it's Democrats, they're unhappy with the performance of their governments. Modi is a great example. India is now the world's fifth largest economy, but Modi has not been able to create the millions of jobs that he needs to lift so many people out of poverty, which, of course, is what China did over many, many years. And this cost him at the polls. Generally, there's a lot of discontent out there. And one of the concerns is that can lead, particularly in Western democracies, people to go for more autocratic people, more autocratic populists.
And have we seen setbacks for democracy this year as well?
Absolutely. You know, in February, you and I were talking about this earlier, Nayib Bukele, he calls himself the world's coolest dictator. He won a landslide in El Salvador, and he's been very successful because of this brutal crackdown on gangs. And he was only able to actually run because his allies in the legislature, they stacked the Supreme Court so he could run in back-to-back terms. You know, another example is Indonesia. If you go back to 1998, President Suharto, he was the dictator. He was forced out of power, and Indonesia became a really successful democratic story. You now have a new president. He was alleged to be involved in human rights abuses, and he's Suharto's former son-in-law.
Frank, of course, we're coming up to elections here in the fall. What effect might elections here in the United States have on the state of democracy around the world?
When I talk to people about this, there's a universal consensus of analysts that if Trump wins, it could be profound. As we know, former President Trump admires autocrats, transactional by nature, and there's a really good example of the impact this could have. You remember back in last year in Guatemala, there was this anti-corruption campaigner, Bernardo Revelo. He won, but corrupt politicians, they tried to block him. The Biden administration got involved, put a lot of pressure on, and in fact, Arevalo was able to take office. I was talking to Scott Mainwaring. He's a political scientist at Notre Dame. He says if Trump had been in the White House, it would have been a different story.
I think it's very unlikely that the Arevalo inauguration would have happened, right? I mean, for the Trump administration, and they're very clear about this, democracy in Latin America is not a priority.
So, Scott, I think no matter what happens here on November 5th, I think the results are going to reverberate around the world.
NPR's global democracy correspondent Frank Langford, thanks so much.
Great to talk, Scott.
Tonight, the Florida Panthers face off against the Edmonton Oilers in Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals. But wait, it's not time for sports. It's time for hockey romance novels. Titles like Icebreaker, Taking a Shot, Body Check, and Pucked. Oh my. Hockey romances. Hot literature right now. Can't you see the ice steaming? Washington Post reporter Rachel Curzius is a student of the romance subgenre and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's an honor. Thanks for having me.
Do you have to be a hockey fan to like hockey romance novels?
You do not have to be a fan. In fact, I would say for me, it was the novels that got me interested in hockey rather than the other way around.
I confess, and I'm not proud of this, I've never read one. What am I missing?
Romance in general can be so thrilling, and hockey as a sport ups the ante in so many ways. There are a lot of moments of drama. We're talking about attractive athletes who make a lot of money at the pinnacle of success.
They have no teeth.
You know, I think that...
I say that with respect, but yeah.
Oh, of course. But the level of fantasy that comes into it is most of the romantic leads, I would say, have their teeth or are seeing dentists where they're getting at least fake versions of those teeth back. I also think that there becomes a contrast between the brutality of the sport and the softness that the romance brings out in the player or the coach or the hockey person. And that kind of gets at the fantasy that a lot of romance novels are telling us, which is that in the places you least expect it, you can find this thrilling connection.
Gosh, I've been missing something.
Have you ever? But you can fix this.
I gather hockey romance novels have been around for a while. What makes them suddenly popular?
I wouldn't say that they're necessarily suddenly popular. I mean, I think that as soon as, and this is true in publishing as it is in so many different areas of life, as soon as there seems to be some sort of formula for success, you see a lot of people then try and work on that. So I think it's a bit of a self-reinforcing cycle. As soon as hockey romances reached some degree of popularity, other people thought, hey, maybe I should set my next novel in this world of hockey. So once it got a little bit of success, that just continued and continued.
You have a section for us, a reading, right?
I do. And it is from the book that got me into hockey romance. It's what I would call my sacred text. It's called Heated Rivalry by Rachel Reed, and it is about two hockey players who are rivals who, and I'm not spoiling it for you because all romances have happy endings, but they do find love, but before then, they're kind of in denial of their feelings. And this
You mean
is
they find love with each other?
Yes, they do. They're a subgenre of the hockey romance would be gay hockey romance, where it's players or two men or two women. I mean, any formulation that you could imagine a romantic partnering, you'll find in this subgenre. But so Heated Rivalry is about Shane and Ilya, and I'll read you this section and know that I am not using any of the curse words that may be in there. Why was Shane Hollander so hard to shake? They'd hooked up once, months ago. It had been a mistake, obviously, or at the very least, something that should be forgotten about. Not a big deal. On the ice, it was easy enough to focus on the game. Ilya actually loved playing against Hollander. He would never actually tell him, but Hollander was really good. He challenged Ilya in ways that Ilya wasn't used to. He loved taking the puck from Hollander. He loved slamming him into the boards. He loved smack-talking him because his eyes would get all squashed up in anger, and his pink lips would curl into an adorable little attempt at a snarl, like an angry kitten. Okay, it wasn't entirely easy to focus on the game.
I can see where this would become hypnotic for people, right? You keep coming back.
Very much so. The other thing that I would be remiss not to include when we're talking about hockey is that the romance genre, as with publishing more broadly, has faced some struggles when it comes to diversity of authors, of main characters. And hockey is a broadly white sport. And I think that for some people, that could be some of the appeal, or at least it's worth noting.
Can we have a recommendation?
Well, Heated Rivalry, which I just mentioned, is one that, like I said, is wonderful to me. And anything by Rachel Reed, I highly recommend. Another that I read recently and loved was The Fake Out by Stephanie Archer. But what I would also say is that if you are a fan of romance, let's say you love Rivals to Lovers, Friends to Lovers, whatever trope suits you, if you search that plus hockey romance, you're bound to find something that you'll like.
Rachel Curzius is a reporter for the Washington Post. Thank you so much for being with us. I think you've changed the way I see the world.
Love to hear that.
Our theme music this week is by BJ Lederman with assistance from Celine Dion. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The Oakland Ballers, Oakland's new Pioneer League baseball team, is in the midst of their first series at their new home field at Raimondi Park in West Oakland. Among the players suiting up for the Bees is a boundary-breaking pitcher, Kelsey Whitmore. KQED's culture reporter Ariana Prale has her story.
Now pitching for Oakland, number 9, Kelsey Whitmore.
Taking the mound for the Oakland Ballers the other week against Montana's Glacier Range Riders, Kelsey Whitmore became the first woman to play in the independent pro Pioneer League. She's a right-handed pitcher and says her first outing didn't go as well as she wanted, but she pulled herself together for the next one.
And that's the name of the game. It's just kind of, there'll be ups and downs with it, and it's just like how well you can stay to maintain yourself with your mindset.
Baseball is her life. She's 25, and she's been playing the sport since she was a kid. In 2016, she started her pro career with the Sonoma Stompers, and 6 years later, she became the first woman to sign with a team in the prestigious Atlantic League. She also plays for the Women's USA baseball team, which will compete for a World Cup in August.
You know, when you have something in your heart that just feels right, and you just can't see yourself not doing, like, that's how baseball always felt to me.
Whitmore's desire to compete at a professional level is what stands out most to Ballers manager Micah Franklin.
I mean, it's a big step stepping into this realm, and it is very intimidating, and she is not intimidated at all.
Whitmore says she's had to train her mind over the years to handle being a woman in baseball, where she's faced plenty of negativity from naysayers.
At first, I let it eat me up, but then I switched it because I was so tired of letting it affect me. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to use it as like fuel to my fire.
Organizations like the Ballers can be more supportive, says Justine Siegel, founder of Baseball for All, a national nonprofit building gender equity in baseball.
I think that minor league baseball is more open to women playing, at least at the independent level.
Siegel, who was the first woman to coach pro baseball as part of the Oakland A's staff in 2015, says that the battle for opportunities to play starts early. From ages 7 and 8, girls get told they need to switch from baseball to softball to pursue a softball scholarship. Whitmore herself got funneled into softball in college. Siegel says that the Ballers being one of the hottest new teams and signing Whitmore sends a great signal.
It shows that they take players who can compete, and that's what women want.
While the surge in support for pro women's sports like soccer, basketball, and hockey has yet to hit baseball, Siegel does notice a shift happening, seeing the growth of her own programs. Whitmore is noticing the shift in attitudes, too. She says people used to attempt to correct her more often when she'd say she plays baseball.
He'll go, you mean softball, like every time. And I've noticed over the years, it's like, now when I say it, they're like, oh, cool, what position do you play?
And if the next question is where she wants to take her baseball career, Whitmore has a clear answer.
I'm trying to get to the big leagues. I'm trying to get as far as I can. That's been the dream.
In the short term, though, her goal is to help the Bees get a championship ring this year for the Oakland fans that she says are more energized than any other fan base she's experienced. I'm Ariana Prail, KQED News.
Whitmore started her first game for the Bees on Thursday night, and she struck out the first batter she faced. The Oakland Bees take on the Yellow Highwheelers at Raimondi Park at 1 this afternoon. I'm Natalia Navarro. You're listening to Weekend Edition on KQED News.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Support for KQED comes from Landmark College, offering academic and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. And Style Bath and Kitchen, a locally owned business bringing tailored kitchens and bathrooms to life for over 25 years with brands such as Toto and California Faucets. Listeners can learn more by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. Well, this week on the Right Now-ish podcast, jazz and hip-hop are technically, well, they're different genres of music, but for one Bay Area bassist and composer, they have an unbreakable connection. Find out more on Right Now-ish wherever you get your podcasts. We have cloudy skies to start the day with some hazy sunshine in the forecast, according to the National Weather Service, and those microclimates and full process here with 60s to upper 80s in the Sacramento Valley.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israeli officials say four people who had been held hostage by Hamas since last October are in good medical condition. They were rescued by Israeli forces in what they describe as a high-risk mission. President Biden welcomed the news of the hostage rescue. He said the U.S. won't stop working until all the hostages come home and a ceasefire is reached. He spoke in Paris on a state visit. And Denmark's prime minister was assaulted by a man in central Copenhagen last night. A statement released today says Mette Frederiksen suffered some whiplash and was shaken up but is otherwise fine. A 39-year-old man was arrested for the attack. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Currently 58 degrees in Oakland and 56 in San Francisco. Highs expected later today, 64 in San Francisco and 68 in Oakland, then jumping up to 79, the high expected in San Jose later, and then 88 in Sacramento. Support for NPR comes from Smart Mouth, committed to the prevention of bad breath for 24 hours. Smart Mouth mouthwash, toothpaste, and more can be found nationwide at stores or at smartmouth.com. And Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And the listeners of KQED.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A young girl wanders the streets of Vienna in the days following what was supposed to be the war to end all wars. She does not speak. A neurologist concludes the girl has had no exposure to language and writes her story for a medical journal. But it gets a letter from a sanitarium patient who says he's wrong. The writer is the young girl's father and sends along a collection of 26 bedtime stories to tell her of the times in Vienna. Gretel and the Great War is by Adam Ehrlich-Sachs. He's a novelist and short story writer and joins us now from Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The stories are in alphabetical order, from the architect through the duchess, through the quarryman, and finally the Zionist. How do they reflect Vienna in the wake of the Great War?
Yeah, well, this is an unpublished playwright with certain grievances against the culture that he comes out of. And the ABC structure sort of came from my own, you know, I had a 1.5-year-old daughter when I started this book and was thinking about her and reading a lot of ABC books, many of which I liked more, actually, than supposedly grown-up novels I was reading. So somehow those two merged in my head.
The architect, first story, for example, what do they distrust about decoration?
Yeah, well, many of the stories, or actually all of them, have a kind of historical reference. So this one is, in a way, the clearest. This is based on Adolf Loos, who is a famous architect, and he wrote an essay called Ornament and Crime, where he said that highly decorative buildings are not only unnecessary, it's actually immoral. Children can have ornament, can scribble on the walls, but it's too late in the day for a grown-up civilization. So he was all about stripping away everything unnecessary. And that was happening not just in architecture, but in music with Schoenberg, in philosophy with Wittgenstein, in the media and somewhere with Karl Kraus, the satirist. So there was a lot of ruthless self-critique and a kind of calling out of the language operating in all of these fields and saying it's meaningless.
What led you to set a novel with these stories in post-World War I Vienna now?
Somehow having a child of my own made an emotional link to the material that I hadn't had before. There's a lot of interest in language, in what is nonsense and what is sense. And it all felt a little bit academic until I had a one-year-old who was acquiring language on her own and also losing the beautiful nonsense words of a one-year-old in a way that I kind of found sort of heartrending in a way. You know, I have a three-year-old now who still calls a cucumber a cucubator, and I know that the day that he learns it's a cucumber will be a dark day in my life.
But so you'll go on saying cucubator. That's been my
That's experience. True. Yeah. But he won't like that anymore, though. So yeah, somehow emotional in that sense. And then, of course, I'm not generally interested in making a political point, but there are parallels that I couldn't avoid between then and now.
It was during the story, in fact, about the kindergarten teacher, the K, that I began to, as a reader, detect a pattern of anti-Semitism in Vienna when they speak about doctors.
Well, it ends with Z, the Zionist, and...
The Yid and the Zionist.
The Yid and the Zionist.
Y and the Z, yes.
Yeah. One strand of my interest in the material was with Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism. I hadn't quite understood the degree to which he was really a creature of this exact society. He was an editor at the main newspaper, the Neue Freie Presse, and also a wannabe playwright, and came to Zionism kind of accidentally. And I didn't just want to take what we knew would happen and read it anachronistically back into 1918 Vienna, mm-hmm. Because the characters at the time, they certainly didn't know, obviously, and many of them were. Karl Kraus was very anti-Zionist, quite committed to a European view of things. And as foolish as it might seem after the Holocaust, those are powerful essays he wrote against Zionism. And I was interested in that part of it, too.
Well, we get back to why did you want to tell the story now?
I mean, I think the heart of it for me, all the politics and the Judaism and the threat of war aside, it is at heart about a father and a daughter. You know, I've written books before about my own parents, and there's something about fathers, mothers, children that I just can't get away from. It seems like, you know, lovers don't interest me. Friends somehow don't interest me. There's something about a parent who creates someone else and then, you know, watches them take their own form that is just endlessly interesting to me. And I try to look for other material, but I keep getting drawn back to that. So having exploited my parents for material, it was inevitable that I would take my children in turn, but I hope I disguised everything enough. I put everything a century ago. So
how do you feel about the way the term Zionism is sorry to make it sound so casual, but just thrown around these days?
Well, to give a stupid answer, it's complicated. I'm not saying anything that people don't already know, but it comes out of an excruciating history, but a story that in some way begins in pre-war Vienna. You know, Hitler was there and Herzl were there, but it also, you know, has taken on a life of its own and a dynamic of its own, which I also find excruciating.
I have to tell you, and I almost never say this to somebody we're interviewing, but you sound very uncomfortable talking about this. Why?
Well, I mean, have you been following the news for the past half year? It's tricky. I'm also my views are, they've changed. I also, to my regret, was one of those American Jews that felt like they didn't need to pay attention to what was going on over there. We also lived down the street from Tree of Life, the synagogue here, and
that was the synagogue that was attacked. Yes,
that was attacked in 2018. I was with actually my daughter behind it as the shooting happened. You know, so I'm by no means a denier of anti-Semitism, but I wouldn't call myself a Zionist. I think what is happening to Palestinians is the most grotesque thing, clearly, but to any American Jew that would browbeat me into supporting Israeli policies out of concern for my safety, I detest more than anything, because just looking at my children, the people that I love most and I'm concerned most in the world, it terrifies me that we are some way implicated in what Israel is doing.
Israel was attacked on October 7th, wasn't it?
Of course, yes. Yeah. By the way, I have to say, I did not expect a debate on Zionism, but I'm happy to do it. But yeah, you wrote
a book where it's a theme.
I know. Yeah, it's true.
I'm not taking that out of nothing.
No. It's completely fair. Yeah, they were attacked. It was a despicable attack as well. It was also an attack that was in a context of a century of turmoil and in the context of an occupation. And whatever your feelings about that day, and I agree that it was horrible, that, you know, unless you want to subscribe to a, he hit me first sort of view of things, it doesn't to me justify at all what's happening now.
I have to ask another question about Gretel.
Sure.
Does she not speak, or does she just have nothing to say?
Huh. I should keep that. I like that ambiguity. You know, one seed of this was the story of Caspar Hauser, which was a German boy who in the 19th century entered Nuremberg capable of saying one sentence. And he was taken in and taught to speak, but probably he was a fraud. So I like possibly annoyingly intentional ambiguities. But no, I think it would be a long time to remain silent if she had something to say.
Gretel and the Great War is the new novel by Adam Ehrlich Sachs. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha on the ground with an aid group working in Gaza. You can hear that report on your phone, online, or radio with your NPR member station. And for more of NPR's coverage, including differing views and analysis of the conflict, you can go to npr.org/Mideast Updates. Got a question to ask now. Dear Amy, why are you leaving Ask Amy? Amy Dickinson is leaving her widely syndicated Ask Amy advice column for the Chicago Tribune at the end of this month. For 21 years, she's offered advice about love, marriage, transitions, friendship, relatives, and relationships, broken hearts, bruised feelings, work-life balance, coming out, and stepping up for people. Amy Dickinson joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Why are you leaving?
You know, it's so funny. At my age, people keep congratulating me on my retirement. And my answer is, no, dude, I'm quitting. I quit. I mean, I wanted to be maybe the first advice columnist ever not to die at her desk. And honestly, I think I took really to heart. I have taken to heart the lessons I've learned from giving advice. And here's what I know. I get one life and I have plans. So I'm leaving.
Can we ask what the plans are?
Yeah. I am opening a little lending library in my hometown. And I'm really committing to, trying to get kids in after school. I want to sell candy. But also, I plan to write books and really just take a lot of what I've learned over the last 21 years and apply these things to my own life.
What kind of responsibility is it to offer advice to people, you know, not about cooking or clothes or even politics, but the most intimate and compelling questions of their lives?
It's huge. It feels huge. But, you know, and in this regard, I go back to something Ann Landers said to her longtime editor, Rick Kogan, in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Rick passed this along to me when I first started writing this column. And he said, Ann Landers said to me, these problems aren't my problems. I have my own problems. So often I have gone back to that because I think it really is necessary to learn how to detach, how to be helpful as much as you can. But life goes on.
Let me ask you about one of your most quoted and noted replies. November 2013, a parent who signed Feeling Betrayed said he wanted his son to, quote, stop being gay. Do you remember what you told him?
I actually emailed back and forth with that man a few times because I really wanted clarity. Like, I sort of couldn't believe it. And I said something to the effect of, I have an idea. Why don't you stop being straight? And then you can show them how easy it is. So, yeah, that was a good one.
Just between you and me, as they say. Did you ever get sick and tired of being asked for advice?
Yeah. Yes, honestly. And yeah, it is sort of exhausting. And Scott, I mean, come on. Some of these trends, like gender reveals.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe that I have had to take questions from people about challenges related to their gender reveal parties. It's so stupid. I'm like, here's my advice to you. Never do that.
This is a tough one. Have you ever regretted any advice you've given someone?
I have. I absolutely have. I can honestly, though, only think of one time when I have regretted something I had published. But I will say, in that case, I was very much in touch with the person who wrote to me. And that person did not feel that I had made a mistake. But the rest of the world did. Oh, wait. Okay. I have a couple of... I've been pranked. So
really?
a classic way to prank an advice columnist is to base your question on the plot of a television show or a movie. So I caught one that I know Dear Abby did answer. I caught one that was obviously based on an episode of The Simpsons. But I missed one that was based on a famous episode of Seinfeld. And I ran the question as if it was legit because I thought it was. I answered it, and the reaction was, when this was published, was instantaneous. You know, Amy got pranked. It was so hilarious. Yeah, that was no fun.
I don't know a better way to put this. How can people be happy?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I will tell you how I've done it, and I have done it. And my mother did it, and I watched her do it. Mm-hmm. You become a miniaturist. You look for the small things to value. You look for the tiny episodes of beauty. You find something or someone to take care of. And you sink back and accept your humanity, your flaws, and you be gentle to yourself and to others. That's how to do it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Amy Dickinson, Ask Amy, leaving her column at the end of this month to run a library, write books. Hope we talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Oh, my God. Now I'm crying. Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Me too. But it's not hard to make me cry.
I know. We're both such blubber babies. Oh, my God. All right. Well, thank you so much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
It's Been a Minute coming up next on KQED Public Radio, where support for NPR comes from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. Let's do a traffic check now. We're going to go to Mill Valley. Lori Sanders.
And we're going to head to southbound 101 at Tiburon Boulevard. It's a car out of gas, and it's blocking the second lane from the right. In Fairfield, westbound 12 after I-80, watch out for some boxes blocking the right lane. And heading down to San Jose, southbound 101 at Julian Street, it's a garbage can that's rolling around in the two right lanes. Lori Sanders for KQED.
Thank you so much, Lori. Traffic support comes